everybody. Welcome back to the 13 Club podcast. This is magical episode number 20. Can you believe we've made it?
Oh, wow. I mean, it's kind of weird because we do postmortem, so it's like we've done more than 20. But yeah, that's impressive. Look at us. We're actually recording the podcast. We're actually doing this thing.
We're staying regular. Not that it necessarily matters to you guys, but one of the ways that we've found to like keep our momentum going is we record maybe a couple of like postmortems together or a postmortem together with a full-length episode, and it helps us really like make sure we stay on time.
Yeah. Anyway, in case you didn't know, my name's Kim.
And my name is Miranda.
Yay.
Yeah, I'm feeling in a celebratory mood about our episode 20.
Hell yeah.
It took us 3 years, but we made it to episode 20.
That's fine. I think we have good momentum now.
I'm feeling good about it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start off this time. Mm-hmm. Last time, not only last full episode, but also the last time we recorded something, Kim went first. So I'm going to take my turn. And my topic this time is, because we've done a lot of, like, really good, like, murder cases and hauntings and stuff, I kind of wanted to do a little bit of, like, a light palate cleanser and talk about something that's more of just, like, a kind of an oddity that I found.
Mm-hmm.
Just to, you know, shake it up a little bit. I originally found this, somebody posted on, it was, I think, I linked it somewhere. Goodness. Yeah, it was the non-murder mysteries subreddit.
Love that sub. It's like my favorite sub.
It's really good. But it's r/ non-murder mysteries. We, you know, at this point, I'm sure you can tell, we get a lot of our inspiration from Reddit. But this was kind of, I'm kind of conflicted about the reason that this is in non-murder mysteries, because the more I looked into it, it's kind of clearly not a mystery at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a weird thing. And that's fine, too. Not everything, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But the post is titled The Untold Story, Blue People Inhabited Kentucky in the 1950s. And the user for this was u/ Zenona _ Motil. I don't know if I'm saying that right, so I'll spell it, but it's Zenona _ Motil.
Mm-hmm.
But what they did really was they just posted they didn't like write up anything, they just posted a link to a website called Anomalian, which had some good information in it, but was like, and not to dig on this website too much or the person who wrote this article too much, it was extremely difficult to follow because they did a lot of like weird time jumps and quotes that were not like well established who was saying what, and sometimes they tried to do this thing where the person they were interviewing had an accent and they tried to write the accent into the article, and sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't, and in this article it did not. So I pulled from a couple other articles. All of them are going to be up on our website to accompany this episode, but the a bulk of the quotes that I found were from the Anomalian article. So that stuff will be up there. This kind of talking about the blue people of Kentucky, it kind of feels like it would be something that's in those like weird USA books. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I love those.
I had a
they used one to of my sell friends... them at like the check stand at the grocery store.
Did they?
Yeah, they had like, I forgot what they were. Like, there was the National Enquirer, which is like celebrity shit, but then there was like the weird ones that, at least in California, they used to be like right by the check stand, and they'd be like, Bat Boy was found, like blah blah blah. And I would always want to get them. My mom was like, no, it's garbage. Well, I like trash, like, mom. I like trash.
You are a raccoon. My friend in elementary school, I had a really good friend named Jordan, and she had one of those, it was like a hardbound book called Weird USA, and it would have like one or two things from every state. And this, I remember, and this is kind of neither here nor there, but I think it's a funny story. There was one, I don't even remember what state it was, but it was, like, Pumpkinhead people. Have you heard of this?
No.
It's, like, maybe I'll cover it someday, or maybe I'll do a postmortem on it, but it was this, like, one state had a myth about people that, like, had, like, lived up in the mountains and, like, inbred a ton, and because they were so inbred, this one, like, scientist in the 40s or 50s, like, went up there to, like, kind of study them, because he was like, wow, that's some serious inbreeding.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, they became more and more, like, violent, both because of the inbreeding and as a result of his tests. And they, like, the guy went missing. And now it's like, don't go up into the hills or the, like, Pumpkinhead people will get you. And they're called Pumpkinheads because they're so, like, mutated and deformed from both, like, experiments and their, like, lack of a family tree. But she, when we were kids, her bedroom was in this room kind of off the back of their house that was, like, on three sides it was a window. So, like, three of the four walls in this room were windows, and it was kind of, like, facing up against some woods. And we, like, read that story and got so spooked, we were convinced that Pumpkinhead people were gonna come out of the woods and, like, be able, like, we had that moment of, like, it was dark, we had the lights on in the room, like, we, you know, so people could see in to her room, but we couldn't see out, and we were like, there are Pumpkinhead people out there watching us right the fuck now.
So,
and
I remember, like, was it like a deformity that made their heads look like pumpkins?
Yeah, it was like, I'm not sure that they, like, I wouldn't say that they literally looked like pumpkins, that was just like the name people had, but it was like they had, like, maybe that, like, hydrocephalic type swelling. Mm-hmm. Where their brains were kind of watery and their eyes were kind of in like the wrong places on their heads. They just looked really swollen and mm-hmm. lumpy.
Cute.
But we got so scared by the Pumpkinhead people. I think we, like, slept in the living room. I remember being, like, really upset. But anyway, that was in a Weird USA book. And this kind of feels like a similar type story. Thankfully, there's no, like, monstrous, murderous pumpkin people, but this is similarly kind of an oddity type story more than a, like, a scary story.
Mm-hmm.
The, like, blue people of Kentucky, is this something you've heard of before?
No,
so, okay, I hadn't either, so this is new to me as well. So our story is going to kind of start out in 1960 with a hematologist whose name was Madison Cowan. And just to get it out there for anyone who might not know, a hematologist studies blood.
Mm-hmm.
I know you are studying some blood-related stuff or preparing to study some blood-related stuff in the near future.
Phlebotomy.
Do you know, maybe you don't know off the top of your head, but do you know if there's any overlap between maybe hematology and phlebotomy besides just blood stuff?
I mean, you process all the lab results for hematology.
Okay, so okay, I see what you... So you're kind of like the secondary... A hematology person does one thing and then you guys process it, maybe.
Right. Well, we draw the blood and process it and give them the results that they need. Yeah.
So this maybe the story will be of, like, some interest to you from a, like, professional standpoint.
from a blood perspective.
Exactly. So in 1960, Cowan started working at the University of Kentucky Lexington's medical clinic, and while he was working there, he started to hear rumors of people who had a distinct blue skin tone. And what are you kind of supposed to think when you hear something like that? You know, like, to me, upon first hearing something like that, I would think it sounds like some kind of rumor or, like, a statement built on a misunderstanding, because mm-hmm. people aren't blue.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it can be said people turn... Yeah, people can turn blue from, like, mm-hmm. lack of oxygen.
Yeah.
Hypothermia. And blood is, blue, mm-hmm. right? Am I right? Mm-hmm. Until it contacts oxygen, and that's, like, red blood that we all see.
That's actually, I don't think that's actually true. Yeah, human blood is never blue. The bluish color of the veins is only an optical illusion.
Ooh, so I just learned something. Thank you. But like, blue people sounds fake, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Pixar, it didn't happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Cowan was especially intrigued by these rumors, and he became obsessed with investigating them. And he started just kind of talking to anybody he could about it.
Mm-hmm. He's like, do you know about these blue people? Hey, do you want to have a beer?
Can you tell me more about this? Hi, hello. Have I told you about the blue people? One of the stories he heard was from a nurse whose name was Ruth Pendergrass, who herself had been trying to stir up interest in blue people after she encountered one herself. She had been working at the American Heart Association Clinic in Hazard, Kentucky, when one day a woman that she described as dark blue walked into the clinic seeking a blood test. She'd been out in the cold, but she was just blue, recalled Pendergrass. Her face and her fingernails were almost indigo blue. It like to scared me to death. She looked like she was having a heart attack, and I just knew the patient was going to die right there in the health department, but she wasn't at all alarmed. She told me that her family was the Blue Combses, who lived up on Ball Creek, and that she was a sister to one of the Fugate women. About this same time, a Luke Combs had taken his sick wife up to the clinic at Lexington, which had also caused a big stir, according to Pendergrass. With this information, Pendergrass and Colin kind of joined forces in their search for these reclusive blue people, and what that came to mean was literally them driving back and forth between Lexington and Hazard, more or less constantly, to question people, inquire at health facilities, and literally, I'm not joking, they said that they literally wandered around streets, fields, neighborhoods, hoping that they might see these people firsthand just by walking around enough, which is dedication, I feel like. That's really was also not a small feat when you take into account that they said the trip between Hazard and Lexington at that time was an 8-hour ordeal. I looked it up on Google Maps. That distance now you could drive like in 2 hours. But that was an 8-hour thing for them. So one day, Colin was just hanging out at the Hazard American Health Association clinic, and I assume he was waiting for Ruth at that point, since we know that she worked there. When by, I guess, a stroke of luck, Patrick and Rachel Ritchie walked in, and you guessed it, they were blue. Colin was startled, but he quickly approached them. Colin remembers the pain that showed on the Ritchie brothers and sisters' faces. They were really embarrassed about being blue, he said. Patrick was all hunched down in the hall, and Rachel was leaning against the wall. They wouldn't come into the waiting room. You could tell how much it bothered them to be blue. After talking to them about his search and explaining his interest in what was going on with them, he began to examine them. His first thought was to have them checked for different things, to like try and figure out what the source of the mysterious condition was. His time interviewing and investigating the rumors of the blue folks in Hazard County had led him to several theories that had been put forth by locals. Local people in the town said that maybe it was heart disease or lung conditions. One old-timer that they interviewed simply said that, quote, maybe their blood was just closer to the skin than most folks, and that would account for why they were blue. However, after spending time with the couple and running a variety of tests, he ruled out all of those kind of things that people thought maybe this is why they look this way. Next, the doctor suspected something that I'm going to say incorrectly, but please bear with me. He suspected methemoglobinemia.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably not right, but it's a rare hereditary blood disorder that results from excess levels of methemoglobin in the blood. Methemoglobin, which is blue, is a non-functional form of the red hemoglobin that carries oxygen. It is the color of oxygen-depleted blood seen in blue veins just below the skin. So in a way, like, maybe that's not necessarily completely wrong from the, like, person who's like the, oh, maybe it's just below the skin theory.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't know how that works enough to say, particularly if, like you said, that's kind of an optical illusion or
a myth. Yeah, it is.
So,
blood is just a lot darker red when it's deoxygenated.
Okay.
And when it hits oxygen, it becomes more of like a bright red.
Okay. So yeah, anytime you've got like more facts on this, please chime in, because I'm going to defer to you as the expert.
Think about it this way. If you're drawing blood from someone, there's no oxygen in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's no oxygen in the tubes. Because they're vacuum tubes. So there's right. no oxygen in there, and it's red coming through the tube.
True. Okay. That's makes perfect sense.
I just, like, quickly looked it up, and this is from The Conversation, and it says, human blood is red because of protein hemoglobin, which contains a red-colored compound called heme that's crucial for carrying oxygen through your bloodstream. Heme contains an iron atom which binds to oxygen. It's this molecule that transports oxygen from your lungs to other parts of the body. Chemicals appear particular colors to our eyes based on the wavelengths of light they reflect. Hemoglobin is bound to oxygen and absorbs blue-green light, which means that it reflects red-orange light in our eyes, appearing red. That's why when blood turns bright cherry red, red when oxygen binds to its iron. Without oxygen connected, the blood is a much darker color. Sometimes blood can look blue through our skin. Maybe you've heard that blood is blue in our veins because when headed back to our lungs, it lacks oxygen. But this is wrong. Human blood is never blue. The bluish color of veins is only an optical illusion. Blue light does not penetrate as far into the tissue as red light. If the blood vessel is sufficiently deep, your eyes see more blue than red reflected due to the blood's partial absorption of red wavelengths.
Okay.
So, yeah.
No, that was very helpful. The doctor, Dr. Colin, is thinking if the blue people did have methemoglobinemia,
mm-hmm.
the next step was to find out the cause of it. Mm-hmm. It can be brought on by several things, abnormal hemoglobin formation and enzyme deficiency, and taking too much of certain drugs, including vitamin K, which is essential for blood clotting and is abundant in pork liver and vegetable oil. So Colin drew a lot of blood from the Ritchies and hurried back to his lab, where he tested first for this abnormal hemoglobin formation, but the results were negative. At this point, the doctor was stumped, and he turned to medical literature for a clue, and he found references to methemoglobinemia during the turn of the century, but without any real, like, detail that was helpful. But then he came across E. M. Scott's 1960 report in the Journal of Clinical Investigation, which is volume 39 from 1960, that the answer began to emerge. Scott had been a public health service doctor at the Arctic Health Research Center in Anchorage, who had discovered hereditary methemoglobinemia among Alaskan Eskimos and American Indians, or I guess I should say, like, North American Indians. It was caused, Scott speculated, by an absence of the enzyme diaphorase from their red blood cells. In normal people, hemoglobin is converted to methemoglobin at a very slow rate. If this conversion continued, all the body's hemoglobin would eventually be rendered useless. Normally, diaphorase converts methemoglobin back to hemoglobin. Scott also concluded that the condition was inherited as a recessive trait. So, in other words, to get this disorder in a hereditary way, a person would have to inherit two genes for it, one from each parent. Somebody with only one gene would not have the condition, but could pass the gene to a child. What this suggested was, if the people in Scott's study were, in fact, like the blue people that we're seeing here in Kentucky, this would strongly suggest that the trait was the result of inbreeding in the family line.
Also, just, like, one quick thing. I just looked at it, and it just says that, like, methemoglobinemia, it's ferric iron with reduced oxygen binding capability, and it's supposed mm-hmm. to be ferrous iron, and that's the normal condition.
Ah, okay.
So, there's some science for you.
Yeah, more science. This is a very science-heavy episode so mm-hmm. far. So, to follow up kind of on this idea, Colin needed some fresh blood to do an enzyme assay. He returned to Hazard to search out the Ritchies, who lived in a, like, tapped-out mining town called Hardburley. They introduced Dr. Colin to meet Zach Big Man Fugate, the 76-year-old patriarch of the clan in the area known as Troublesome Creek, and Zach took the doctor even further up the Copperhead Hollow to see his Aunt Bessie Fugate, who was also blue, and graciously allowed the doctor to draw some of her blood. Just like the Alaskans, their blood had accumulated so much of the blue molecule that it overwhelmed the red of normal hemoglobin that shows through as pink in the skin of most Caucasians. Once he had the enzyme deficiency isolated, I'm going to say this wrong again, methylene blue, also known as methylonium chloride, is a medication and dye. As a medication, it had previously been used for cyanide poisoning and, like, urinary tract infections. That is no longer a recommended use, so don't be trying that. But at the time, that was kind of what it was thought of as being for. Some of the blue people thought the doctor was crazy for suggesting that taking a blue dye would turn them pink. But Colin knew from earlier studies that the body has an alternative method of converting methemoglobin back to normal. Activating it requires adding the blood to a substance that acts as an electron donor. Many substances do this, but Colin chose methylene blue because it had been used successfully and safely in other cases and because it acts quickly. So he packed up his medical black doctor's bag and he rounded up Nurse Pendergrass for this big event. They went over to Patrick and Rachel Ritchie's house and injected each of them with 100 milligrams of methylene blue. Within a few minutes, the blue color was gone from their skin, the doctor said. For the first time in their lives, they were pink and they were delighted. They changed colors, remembered Pendergrass. It was really something exciting to see. The doctor gave each blue family a supply of methylene blue tablets to take as a daily pill. The drug's effects are temporary, as methylene blue is normally excreted in the urine. One day, one of the older mountain men cornered the doctor, and he said, "I can see that old blue running out of my skin." Before Colin ended his study of the blue people, he returned to the mountains to try and patch together the long and twisted journey of this recessive gene. From a history of Perry County and some of the, like, Fugate family Bibles that, like, went, like, way back, listing back generations. And he has a pretty good idea, a fairly complete story of that family history. So, Martin Fugate was a French orphan who immigrated to Kentucky in 1820 to claim a land grant on the wilderness banks of Troublesome Creek. No mention of his skin color is made in early histories of the area, but family lore has it that Martin himself was blue. He married a woman who carried the same recessive gene, Elizabeth Smith, who was not known to be blue. Martin and Elizabeth set up housekeeping on the banks of Troublesome and began a family, and of their 7 children, 4 were reported to be blue. The clan kept multiplying, Fugates married other Fugates, sometimes they married first cousins, and they married the people who lived closest to them, the Combses, Smiths, Ritchies, and Stacys. This was a really, really isolated community. Again, this is super duper rural Kentucky, beginning in the 1880s. They lived in isolation from the world, bunched in log cabins up and down the hollows, so it was kind of, at that time, only to an extent, it was only natural that a boy married the girl next door, even if she had the same last name. The railroad didn't come through eastern Kentucky until the coal mines were developed around 1912, and it took 30 or 40 years after that to lay down roads. So, like, they were really, like, living out there at the time. And those roads were developed along the, like, local creeks. Martin and Elizabeth Fugate's blue children multiplied in this natural isolation tank. The marriage of one of their blue boys, Zachariah, to his mother's sister triggered the line of succession that would result in the birth more than 100 years later of one Benjamin Stacy in 1975. Benjamin Stacy is one of the last of the blue Fugates. He was born with intensely blue blood at birth, but his skin eventually faded back to normal Caucasian tones after a few weeks, and he has not turned blue since. With Fugate blood on both his mother and his father's side, the boy could have received the genes from the enzyme deficiency from either direction. Because the boy was intensely blue at birth, but then recovered his normal skin tones, Benjamin is assumed to have inherited only one gene for the condition. Such people tend to be very blue only at birth, probably because newborns normally have smaller amounts of DF4As, and the enzyme eventually builds to normal levels in most children and to almost normal levels, like in those like Benjamin who carry one gene. So obviously, as coal mining and railroads and the construction of actual roads kind of brought more people into Kentucky, the blue Fugates started moving out of their communities and marrying other people. The strain of the inherited blue began to disappear as the recessive gene spread to other families where it was unlikely to be paired with a similar gene. Colin and his colleagues published their research on hereditary DF4A's deficiency in the Archives of Internal Medicine in April 1964. He hasn't studied the condition for years, even so, Colin still gets calls for advice when folks encounter the rare condition to this day. And as a final note about it, when I was researching this story, I found out there was actually an indie movie that came out in 2015 titled Blue. I actually couldn't find a ton of info about it except for the IMDb page, and there was an LA Times review about it. It seemed to be heavily inspired by this story and this family. Mm-hmm. It's about a man who I think they only call him Blue. Like, they just refer to him as if his name is Blue, mm-hmm. who leaves his isolated community for the nearest town where he's distrusted and feared because of his skin, but he meets a woman who can see past his looks, but has dark secrets of her own. I honestly don't plan on watching this, but if one of you guys does, let us know what you think. What I would be more interested in, and couldn't find, but I would love to know what the Fugate family or their descendants think about their story being adapted with this kind of creative license for an indie film.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't find any information about that anywhere. So that is my story about the oddity, the genetic oddity of the Blue Fugate family of Kentucky.
But there are no real pictures of this.
Hmm?
There are, like, no real pictures of this.
I saw some pictures that I thought were real.
Like, the guy who is, like, called Papa Smurf or whatever, that guy apparently, according to an article, just ate silver or drank.
Oh, really?
Know. Yeah. Hold on. Because that's not him.
There were some pictures that I saw, and some pictures that were attached to this article that were very clearly, I think, photoshopped.
Yeah.
And I would think that most people could tell that. The Papa Smurf guy is definitely the guy that you see the most. And he definitely has a very, like, blue tint. There's a couple pictures I've seen of a woman who looks blue, but she also could just be standing under, like, a weird light. Like,
yeah.
It could be a lighting thing. And there's one that's, like, an old woman. Like, a very old woman with, like, a younger woman. And this picture looks like it was maybe taken in the 70s based on one of the women's haircuts. But I don't know exactly what the source of it is.
It looks like she's
painted. So I don't
painted,
know if that one's fake or
but
not.
But I don't know.
Say what?
It kind of looks like body paint. Like silver body paint. But I don't know.
The very old woman?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately, I think ultimately these people must have existed. There is, like I said, there are medical journals that seem to be documenting something. But yeah, I don't know that there's a lot of credible, at least visual evidence that I can prove. There's a painting that pops up all the time. And I actually did find, I didn't include it here, but I did read there was like kind of a hunt to find the original artist of this painting.
Hmm.
Because the original artist was kind of lost to time. And people did track it down and they did find it. But I think, if I remember correctly, and I could probably pull this article up again and find it if I wanted to, but I don't think he, like, painted the people from reference. Like, I don't think he ever met them and, like, painted them in this, you know, family portrait style. I think he was given information about the family and was instructed to paint it based on that.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be that original Fugate family where they had the father had the blue skin and the mother had the recessive trait, and then the four of the seven kids had the blue skin as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I guess this must be a thing. I don't know that we've got any good photos we can share with you guys about it, but I thought it was interesting.
There's a girl on Ask Me Anything that says, "I'm Meg and I have an extremely rare disorder, idiopathic familial methemoglobinemia."
Yeah,
she's
that's
spelling
the one.
It differently.
Oh.
It has killed me twice and makes my skin take on a blue color. And she has pictures, but she's not like super blue.
There could be, I feel like, almost like the question you almost have to ask yourself is, what is the definition of, like, bright blue? Like,
well, they said indigo at one point, so I was like,
I know.
I don't know about that.
Right. At what point are people exaggerating? Like,
mm-hmm.
This person was, that's like when someone says they look sick and you're like, are you okay? You look green.
Yeah.
But they're just kind of, like, nauseous, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Because it's hard to find details. Like, you found, like, the historical details, but it's hard to find, like, pictures or anything like that. So that is, like, it's kind of a mystery.
Yeah.
You didn't see it yourself.
Right. And if the trait is, like, being bred out of that family. And as society only gets more and more diverse, we're likely to see less and less of it. So this may be a condition that goes away entirely.
Mm-hmm. That was interesting, by the way. I had no idea about that, so thank you.
Yeah, of course.
Mine is actually a request from a friend of the show. Her name is Julie, but she's also known as Saturn Goth on social media. And she sent me some information about some folklore from El Salvador that she grew up with, and it doesn't seem to get a lot of English language attention, so I thought I'd give it a shot. She tipped me off to three characters of legend, but two of them require a little bit of a backstory. So I'm definitely going to pronounce some things wrong, and this first thing is just going to hit me right like a train in the beginning. Ziget? Is it Z-U-I-G-E-T? Ziget? A beautiful Mesoamerican princess was married to the god of the sun. Sometimes they say it's the god of god of rain, though, which is Tlaloc. And she had a hot, steamy affair with Lucifer Morningstar. And let's be real, can you blame her? Through this affair, they conceived a son, and his name is El Cipitio. Well, her husband was not super thrilled about it. So he went to the god Teotl and cursed her and the child. So we'll start with what happened to poor Cipitio. He was cursed to forever be a child who seemed to be about 8 to 10 years old. His feet were twisted backwards as a symbol of the twisted union that bore him. He is a chubby boy who wears indigenous clothing and a big hat, which is described as sort of a cross between a sombrero and a wizard's hat. He's basically a harmless poltergeist with some interesting habits. He loves to spy on pretty girls, especially when they're washing their clothes in the river. He's known to toss stones at them to get their attention. He loves to eat bananas and ashes. He likes to sing and to dance. He can also teleport wherever he likes. Some say he will enter your kitchen at night and leave a huge mess for you to clean up in the morning. And then, of course, I wrote, which I think explains what's going on in my kitchen every night. Da-da. One way to thwart his affections, according to Julie, is to eat in a bathroom because he hates bad habits. He's in some children's cartoons, and there are some books about him, and the Salvadorian educational television station had a show about him where he taught kids morals and values. As for Mom, she was turned into a hideous banshee-like creature with the face of a horse. She's a shapeshifter and appears mostly to men, usually said to be unfaithful or drunkard men wandering around alone. She appears to them as either naked or scantily clad. I found a thin white dress was her usual go-to. She has gorgeous, long, flowing black hair. They rarely see her face until she gets close enough and then she reveals her true form. I found one description of her having a severely deformed face, and I've also heard that she just has, like, a skeleton face. The horse one is the most unique, though, and I think the most terrifying. However she appears, this sight will cause you to die of fright or go insane. Julie said that she would get her confused with La Llorona because as kids they would get told that if they were bad, she would take them away and make them get lost in the forest and never find their way back. Mm-hmm. Another description says that she has been known to take the form of men's wives or girlfriends and children's mothers, and to ward her off, usually you would have to make a symbol of the cross or pray or bite your machete, which was popular in rural areas. Whatever the truth is, she is called La Ciguanaba, and she is doomed to wander and punish those who committed the crime that she committed. And she was never able to find her son, El Cipitio. So, slightly unrelated, but still widely popular in folkloric tales within El Salvador, and even in the surrounding areas, El Cadejo refers to two large dog spirits, one good, the white, and one evil, the black. The black Cadejo appears to those who wander alone at night. His red, burning eyes are said to hypnotize victims and steal their souls. The white Cadejo is said to provide protection, especially to children who faithfully believe in him. One summary I found of them says that the white Cadejo was created by the gods to help the good people of the world. However, the devil got jealous and created his own dog to create havoc and negate the good needs of the white. Some say that the two are really just fighting over the souls, but actually, according to accounts, both have been known to help people. Now, both of Julie's parents were kind enough to lend us their stories about El Cadejo, and here they are. Julie recounts, "My dad says that when he was about 5 or 6 years old, he saw it in his family's plantation in the town of Alegria. I've been there and stayed at the house where he lived. It's huge, and when it gets dark, it's super dark, and you can hear bats in the roof. My family had a coffee plantation, and there were also some fruit trees. One evening, close to when the sun was about to set, but still light enough to see, he came home to find his mom. He goes outside to the back of the house to look for her, and she isn't there, and he thinks perhaps she went to the closest house on the plantation to get some fruit or other food. He goes down an incline down a stone path leading to another building, and on his way, he sees El Cadejo. Now, he pointed out that it wasn't rare to see dogs around the plantation, street dogs or otherwise, but he said it looked off. Too big and almost wolf-like. He said it just looked way too big and made him feel like something was very wrong. El Cadejo was standing there blocking his path and turned his head to look at my dad. It was then that my dad noticed he had red glowing eyes. El Cadejo and my dad stood staring at each other for a long time. My dad said he got goosebumps. He felt like his feet were in cement and was frozen with fear. He said that El Cadejo never barked or moved towards him, just stared. Eventually, my dad felt he could move again and slowly moved back towards his house. El Cadejo never moved and continued to stare. My dad didn't lose sight of him until he made it back to his house." In her mom's account, Julie says, "My mom's experience was when she was about 11. Her cousin asked her to come with her to the river at night for some water. This was a very poor rural area. My mom went with her reluctantly, on the way there, my mom sees two glowing red eyes in the bushes. She gets scared and tells her cousin, who sees the eyes too, so they both decide to turn around and go back home quickly and go to the river in the morning. From then on, they always went in the morning. My mom says that she's pretty sure it was at Cadejo and that it kept them from probably getting into some real trouble." Kind of makes you wonder what would have happened in both cases otherwise.
Right.
A very longtime friend of mine named Mario is from Guatemala. I ran these names by him and he gave me some additional info. Instead of Cipitio, he related this description to El Sombrerón. I looked into him and found that he serves as more of a boogeyman-type creature. Instead of a child, he's a short man with a large black hat and a brilliant belt. He wears heavy boots that are quite loud when he walks. He is said to love horses, and it is a sign that he has ridden your horse in the night if you find a braid in its mane or tail. The commonality between he and Cipitio is their love for beautiful girls/women. El Sombrerón is a stalker, whose advances grow more intense as he gets closer to claiming a young lady's soul. He begins with a serenade, and it gets to the point where she can never sleep because all she hears is his song, and she can never eat because all of her food is contaminated with soil. One way I found that a young lady was able to get rid of him was by cutting off all of her beautiful hair. Before she did so, she almost died. Mario said that he was afraid of horses for quite a while because of La Ciguanaba's horse face. And of El Cadejo, he says, "The white Cadejo is also said to protect passed out drunks and when he finds them on the street. He curls up by them and attacks those who would either rob him or bring them harm. I also found that he helps those drunks find their way back home."
That's really interesting. I really like, those are some interesting, I don't know if I should call them like cryptids or like characters. Just pieces of folklore. Yeah. That's some really interesting like characters.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about them, and then obviously, since this is not my culture, I'm very interested in it, and I'm dying to know about all the creepy stuff from other cultures, and I love it when somebody shares that with me, and I'm very, like, honored. And I'm really fortunate that I was able to interview two different people about it. And I wanted to really, like, make sure I had facts straight. But, right. You know, it's folklore, so there are a lot of different types of facts when it comes to this. I looked it up, and like, there was, like, no videos on any of these. Like, I found one guy who talks about, like, a bunch of sightings of La Ciguanaba, and I think he also talks about El Cadejo. And I was gonna link that for you so you could put it in the blog. But yeah, it's really hard to find information about these guys. And like for Zigit, I tried really hard to find the right pronunciation for that, but I just couldn't.
Yeah, that's, it's always a struggle. Like, we've had that in a lot of our episodes, like the Japanese stuff as well. Sometimes it's easy to stumble over a word or like not be. And this reminds me a bit of also when I was doing the research on El Silbón, back in our early episodes, The Whistler. I think it's really interesting. Not, and I mean, of course, that's not necessarily the same culture, but like a similar type of monster character cryptid.
According to like Mario's side of it, which is Guatemala and Mexico, it is that culture. And there's actually a show on HBO right now, and it's a Spanish language show, and it's called Phantasmagoria, I'm pretty sure. Let me just make sure that that's the correct name. Yeah, it's called Phantasmagorias, and it's on HBO. And they are, it's a bunch of short animated films, and they talk about various characters from South America in folklore. And El Silbón actually has an episode, and they're like really short. They're like 3 minutes, but unfortunately, I couldn't find one with subtitles.
Nah, that's okay. But that's really cool. I think it's also really neat that there's kind of a show that like compiles these different things, and even if it's just like little bite-sized bits about each one, you can kind of sit down and get a dose of that all at once.
I don't know if I still have access to anyone's HBO parents. But I'm going to see if I can get on to, like, the HBO app and see if I can watch it there. And if so, like, if there are subtitles on that, like, the official one. Because some people have uploaded Phantasmagoria episodes that are not El Silbón. But there's, like, a La Llorona one, and there's a few others that I have not heard of. And they did go ahead and subtitle them for us. And I can also include those links in case anybody wants to watch them. Because they really are very visually stunning.
I would love to see some of the ones that you covered today make it to a show like that.
Yeah, I didn't see those yet, but we'll see.
Maybe it's coming. Yeah. I think it's really cool. Thank you so much to Julie and to Mario for taking the time to give us information about those.
Yes, and thanks for looking it over to make sure I didn't make a fool of myself. But if anyone else has information or stories or you want to add to any of these, please let us know, because I'd love to hear your take on it, or if you have any sightings, or if your parents have sightings or grandparents have sightings or things that your parents told you. I'm into it.
Yeah, definitely always. We definitely encourage people to reach out to us with their stories that they'd like to share, or if they have requests on things that they'd like us to cover or to research in some way.
I know it's a lot to ask, but like anyone who's willing to be our guide into a different culture's folklore, that's greatly appreciated.
Yeah, definitely. We would be, as you said before, we would be like honored.
Yeah, I was very honored that Julie came to me with this, and I really appreciate it.
You can reach us through social media and an email. All of those can be kind of found on our website, which is 13club.com. Just make sure you're spelling 13 with Roman numerals, XIII. That's also a good place where you can see our Ko-fi. You can catch, we do like blog posty type write-ups where we list all the sources that we use for our research for our episodes. So you can always like go back and check this stuff out for yourself if you're more interested.
Yeah.
Please leave us a review on whatever app that you're listening to this on.
I'm pretty sure most of the reviews are going through iTunes from what I understand, and we really appreciate positive reviews, because last time I checked, we didn't even have enough to have it show up yet. So that would be awesome if you could do that.
We would love that. I also wanted to briefly, I know we got some really sweet comments from a friend of mine who started listening to the show called his name is Jared. Jared, if you're listening, thank you so much.
Thank you for so much
taking the time to get caught up and spend some time with us.
Yeah,
and then really that extends to all of you guys as well.
Send us creepy stuff, request creepy stuff, ask, just bring up creepy topics, we'll just chat about it.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for listening, and we will see you soon.
Yeah. Be back next week. Bye, guys.
Bye.